Why are you here today? You're here to keep the Sabbath. You want to make sure that your relationship with God is solid and He sees that you worship Him. In clear conscience, you want to make sure you are honoring God. You know you're not the great of the earth, but you want God to know that you distinctly love Him. We find ourselves in a continuing small fellowship, centuries old, doing all we can to demonstrate our faithfulness to God. And we cannot let our friends and sometimes even family dissuade us from our goal, even though it sometimes pains us terribly that they think that they know how to get us off our track and they think we're on the wrong road. But see, we are God's people, soldiers of the Word, and we march forward. There's times when soldiers are victorious. There's times when they're prisoners. There's times when they're refugees, when they're cast out, maybe the product of discrimination. Some of the tricks that Satan uses in his war to derail true Christians have included church government. We've seen that recently. Self-righteousness. Sometimes there's divisions over the subject of prophecy or doctrine. But we need to make sure that we have discernment to see these tools Satan uses to distract us. Make sure that we have our spiritual armor on and that our humility is clear. We can ensure our spiritual footing and stabilize ourselves and improve our relationship with God by keeping the Sabbath. And that's why we're here today. We need to follow the example of our general in battle, Jesus Christ, on the subject of the Sabbath. Christ had two occasions when there was a conflict with the Pharisees on the matter of Sabbath keeping. They're both recorded in Mark and somewhat other of the Synoptic Gospels. There are various other scriptures that tell us about the Sabbath, about the importance of it, preceded by a preparation day. There's the marvelous duality between the weekly Sabbath and the annual Sabbaths. But on these two particular occasions, Christ was brought into question for His activities on the weekly Sabbath, and it really had nothing to do with preparation. In Mark chapter 2, verse 23, through chapter 3, verse 6, we will read of these illustrations where Christ and the Pharisees had conflict over the Sabbath. Mark 2:23. And it came to pass when He went through the cornfields on the Sabbath, His disciples began as they went to pluck the ears of corn. And the Pharisees said, "Behold, why do they on the Sabbath day do that which is not lawful?" So they were looking at their own laws, their own activities, and making this decision that they were wrong. And He said unto them, "Have you never read what David did when he had need and he was hungered, and he and those that were with him? How he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar, the high priest, and did eat the showbread, which is not lawful to eat, but for the priests, and he gave also to them which were with him." Don't you remember reading of that? "And he said to the Pharisees, 'The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath.'" We'll read that phrase a few more times today. Going on with chapter 3, verse 1. He entered again into the synagogue, and there was a man that there which had a withered hand. And so while they judged him with the subject of the grain, now they're going to judge him on the matter of healing on the Sabbath. And the Sadducees watched him whether he would heal that man on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him. And he said unto the man which had the withered hand, stand forth, or come forward. And he said unto them, talking to the Sadducees and Pharisees, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days, or to do evil, to save life or to kill? They held their peace. And when he had looked round about on them with anger, rather strong word, probably not in a personal anger, but an attitude, a source of disgust, Christ was grieved for the hardness of their hearts. So he said unto the man, stretch forth your hand, and he stretched it out. The hand was restored whole as the other. And the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. So they wanted to, in a word, destroy him. At this first reading, we see Christ honoring the Sabbath, but also being judged for his actions to the point that the Pharisees wanted to destroy him. In the first episode, apparently the Pharisees considered the eating of grain from the fields on the Sabbath as breaking of their statutes. They had outlined 39 different Sabbath prohibitions, including harvesting and threshing. And so to pick the grain, rub it between their hands, to loosen the husk, and then to blow the husk out of their hands, leaving just the grain, which they could then pop into their mouth and eat, they considered to be sin. So he was breaking two of their 39 rules. But Christ responded to them in good Pharisaic tradition by quoting Scripture. And he quoted then 1 Samuel 21, verses 1 through 6, where David ate the showbread, or the bread of presence. And he brought them to, okay, now David did that, so what about our law? It's funny sometimes how lists become so important to people. If you go through the 39 laws in that list, one of them has to do with chickens and eggs. And the Jewish Talmud, in their writing of their Mishnah, their law on the Sabbath, you have to be careful about eggs and chickens. Because if it's a chicken, one of your laying hens that has laid an egg, can't eat that egg. That chicken worked. But if the chicken that laid that egg is a hen that you're preparing to roast and you're fattening her up, you can eat that egg. That's part of the chicken that just fell off. And doesn't state it quite that simply. But so it is with the ways men sometimes look at lists. Now, in this first episode, we find some augmentation, as I mentioned, and we can go to Matthew 12. Verse 4. And we'll read through verse 8. Christ entered into the house of God and did eat, or David entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him. It was only for the priests, right? Haven't you read in the law how that the Sabbath days the priest in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless. And so he says, what about this? They're working and doing these sacrifices, and that's not charged against them. Are they a different class of people? And God is not that class sensitive. I think you understand that. But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple, referring to himself. But if you had known what this means, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. And so he says they were not guilty. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. In Hosea 6:6, Christ is quoting from there when he makes these comments, and as recorded by Matthew, 6:6 of Hosea says, for I desired mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. These ways of mercy have been around for a long time. Mercy just didn't enter into the scene when Christ died. Mercy's been around for a long time. And our great God is one that would enjoy giving mercy where it is due and where he can. And I think you understand, I hope you understand, that means that mercy outweighs sacrifice on the Sabbath. And by extension, mercy in life is more important as well. Now, in the second episode that we read in Mark, going through chapter 3 to a degree, we saw the subject of healings discussed. And the Pharisees only allowed healings on the Sabbath when it was a real emergency. And again, you can read of that in their books. And so somehow they knew when a real emergency would take place, and they could make some evaluation as they were evidently EMT certified. But I speak in jest. Here Jesus broadened the principles as understood by the Pharisees to include that you could do good deeds on the Sabbath. It would appear David already knew of this if you read Psalm 25, verse 10. Let me read for you. All the paths of the Lord are mercy and truth, and to such as keep his covenant and his testimonies. Mercy and truth are very important to God. And when we keep his instructions, he's glad to give us mercy. Currently, the population in Judea had invented various forms of Judaism. And Judaism is no more than another religion. It is not God's religion. There were Essenes, Sadducees, Pharisees, mystics, various branches of Judaism. And they did not understand the law of God. And so they had added their own do's and don'ts, and Christ brought this to their attention. And again, in traditional rabbinical style, with scriptural argument and saying, well, is it okay to do good on the Sabbath? I healed this man, his withered hand is now whole. Is it okay to do good on the Sabbath? He employs the logic that it is something to be applied, I think, in our lives. You'll find that this is often in the writings of Christ. If something applies in the lesser, it certainly applies in the major. So if you say, well, okay, a lamb is better and more important than a human, something's wrong there. No, a human is more important than the lamb. So, reading again in Matthew 12, verse 11, he said unto them, which man shall there be among you that shall not have one sheep, and if it fall in a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much then is a man better than a sheep? Wherefore it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath days. And so we sometimes find ourselves doing well. I remember as a child, when we would take our trips to Colorado from Wyoming to go to church services, on one particular Sabbath, we were traveling, and Dad and Mom were talking about the fact that they got married on January 1st. And in Wyoming, at Nebraska, that's snow time. You know, it's blowing. And they had gone to go to their honeymoon, and they had, I think, Dad, was it three blowouts? Three blowouts on January 1st in the middle of the Wyoming snows. And he hiked up to a farmer's house to get some help, and the farmer helped him. And he was recounting this story to us because we had just happened upon a road accident. And there was a woman bleeding, and she'd cut her forehead real bad. She went through the windshield. And this is back in the 50s when they didn't have all the protective glass that we have now. And it was just a mess. And he says, you know, that's the house up there that took care of us. And the farmer's wife had made them some fried chicken, brought it down to the car, and let them have their lunch in the car while the farmer and his son or somebody, fixed those three blowouts. And here we were on the Sabbath, and this accident had happened. And so Dad said, well, get them in the car, and we'll take them to Cheyenne, to the hospital. And the other people there said, well, we've called an ambulance, and Dad, being of the medical field, says, you don't have time for an ambulance to come from Cheyenne. We need to get to the hospital. So they bundled them up, took them to the hospital, and as far as I know, recovered. But anyhow, it is okay to do good on the Sabbath. He says it's something that we should consider. For indeed, a man is more important than a sheep. It's lawful to do well on the Sabbath days. Christ gives us examples that he kept the Sabbath and faithfully did so, worshiping even in the synagogue. I cribbed out four examples of that, two from Mark and two from Luke, that I want to read to you. Mark 1:21. And they went into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day he entered into the synagogue and taught. Mark 6:2. And when the Sabbath day was come, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, from whence has this man these things? And what wisdom is that which is given to him, that even such mighty works are worked by his hands? In Luke 4:16 it says, and he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up for to read. And then just five verses later, Luke 4:21, he began to say unto them, this day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears. So Christ did keep the Sabbath. He taught and read on the Sabbath. He walked to the building so that he could be with others that were Sabbath keepers. And perhaps now is the time to mention, there is a lot of people that keep the Sabbath. There's Seventh-day Adventists, there's Jewish people. There is a branch of Catholicism that keeps Sabbath Saturday. There's a lot of people that keep Sabbath. Right now, we are reconstituting ourselves, somewhat resizing even. We're getting back to basics. And I think that should include Christ and the Sabbath and how we as Christians should be keeping the Sabbath. It's a key to stabilizing ourselves and producing then a foundation that is sure. But in all of that, I've been talking to you about discernment. And so I want you to consider what you could further understand and discern about the Sabbath. As we stabilize ourselves and keep the Sabbath, we know that Christ put it this way, and I read to you Mark 2:27-28. The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. So we talk then today about Sabbath keeping, but I want you to think about it as we go along, you'll see that I'm not as much interested in lists of do's and don'ts as I am in the spiritual and highly sought after way of example from God the Father and Jesus Christ on the whole subject of Sabbath keeping. Certainly the Sabbath is a time of refreshing and reconstitution, and is a time of healing and peace. Now I read to you Mark 2:27, and it says the Sabbath was made for man. It was made. Now I sometimes talk about food. You know I like peanuts, butter, and bread and cheese now, so I might as well keep on going. Joy yesterday made a strawberry rhubarb custard pie. And you can't come home. It's that thick, and it's big enough. She found some rhubarb at one of the local shops there on the side of the road. Was that Shannon's? All you ladies in Zephyr Hills, you can go to Shannon's now and you can get some good rhubarb and strawberries. And she used a recipe in a book that's older than she is. This book looks like it, you know, somebody slobbered this pie all over it years and years ago. It was her mother's cookbook. And so I know the recipe is good. But when she did that, she had to make the filling for the pie. She had to make the dough to make for the pie crust. And it's a double-crusted pie. And she made it. She worked at it. The dough was being spun around in the machine and so on and so forth. Made implies action. And if you remember back in your English days, the ones when you were in high school, you try to forget, there are active verbs and passive verbs. Well, the Sabbath was made. That word made, talking to you from Vine's Expository Dictionary Biblical Words, quote, is geonomi, means to become, translated by the passive voice of the verb to make. And it uses a lot of scriptural examples. In many places, the translators otherwise are defined chiefly by the verb to become. Made then as to become. And when you think about words, and we're going to have to do that for a while here. This is somewhat of a didactic approach. I know what you know. I'm going to show you some things that you haven't learned. And then at the end, you'll know some more things. And you can put them to work, I think, in a more aggressive fashion as to Sabbath keeping. So we have to understand that the Sabbath itself came about because of passive voice of the verb geonomi, which means to become. So that's one thing to remember. There is a verb there. And then it also says, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. The word Lord is kurios in the Greek. And Lord can be also used and translated, and is translated in your King James versions using these four words. Kurios can be God, Lord, Master, or Sir. So the one in charge made the Sabbath. Now the word Sabbath is also used, right? And it comes from the Greek word sabbaton, or sabbata, which is the plural form. It was translated from the Aramaic word, which is often mistaken for a plural, hence the singular. Sabbaton was formed from it. The root of sabbaton means to cease, to desist. So it's a stopping. The double B in sabbaton has an intensive verb, a force. Sabbaton can be written with two B's or one B. when you use two B's, is telling us something that it's twice as important, or it's highlighted. It's something for you to take special note of. That's why it was written with two B's. The idea is not of relaxation or refreshment, but the concept of the cessation from activity. In 94, 95, 96, Dr. Bakayoki, a Seventh-day Adventist, gave a number of lectures across the U.S., and I went to some of them and assisted him in some of them, on some of these words and what they mean. And when you come to the word Sabbath, it means that it's the work of cessation, ceasing to work. And this is important for us to consider. Quoting from Vine's Expository Dictionary, the Old Testament regulations were developed and systematized to such an extent that they became a burden upon the people who otherwise rejoiced in the rest that the Sabbath provided. And they became a byword for absurd extravagance, hence the story of the egg either being laid or falling off the chicken. Two treatises of the Mishnah are entirely occupied with regulations for the observance, so with the discussions in the Gemara on rabbinical opinions. So sabbaton is a noun in the Greek when you use the two B's. It's a noun. In the Hebrew, it's sabbat with two B's, and that's also a noun. But in the Hebrew, the sabbat, S-A-B-A-T, that's a verb. And so you have a word that can be used as a noun or a verb. And the verb is in a passive or inactive word. So linguistically, we need to know that Sabbath can be used as a noun or a verb. It is first used as a verb implying the action of rest. Now, in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, Volume 4, page 247, on the article Sabbath, the noun sabbat with two B's is derived from the Hebrew verb sabbat with one B, ceasing, since the most ancient characteristic of the Seventh-day observance is that all work ceased. And yet, we're left with the Sabbath was made. It was made by ceasing. The Revised Standard Version renders the word Sabbat in all 11 occurrences as solemn rest or a day of solemn rest. Sabbaton refers both to the observance of the seventh Sabbath day and to the feast days. Now I have a handout for you, and if Mr. Orris could pass those out and maybe he'll find someone to help him, I have a handout for you to look at, and you can fill in some spots that I've left blank for you, hoping that you can see then and understand more about the creation of the Sabbath and where it all started going back to Genesis. And we've read what Christ said about it, and he doesn't say a whole lot about, and there's not a lot of examples about Christ keeping the Sabbath. Other than he said it was a time when you should do good, and it was a time when you should be able to eat. So I want you to look at this study of Creation Week. That's what I've titled this paper, thinking about Creation Week from Genesis. My theory, if you'll allow me to use that word, is that if you understand what is covered in Genesis 1 through chapter 2, verse 3, about the creation, you'll understand more about what God's heart was when he gave us the Sabbath. There's a lot of information in Genesis 1 and 2 about the Sabbath. And sometimes it just doesn't pop out at you unless you use some kind of a charting device like I've grown here for you. You'll see there's boxes lined across it, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 series of boxes. And so the first four are titled, What is the Order of Creation for the First 3 Days of Creation? And the second one is, What is the Order of the Next 3 Days of Creation? So we're going to talk about 6 days of creation. Why does Zimmerman have 8 boxes? Well, God does. It's a simple answer. Okay, we know somewhat about verses 1 and 2, which is another topic, interesting though, but I'll move to verse 3. And God said, Let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. He separated it. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. So in Genesis 1, verse 3, God said, in that first day, that's what happened there. And so in that top left box, you might put Genesis 1, 3, and that's day 1. That's the first day of creation. And what happened was he separated light and darkness. I put that in for you. Then we go to verse 6, and God said, Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was good. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. So on day 2, he divided waters, and there was room below for life. So God said. And that's part of the key that I'm using in this little sheet. Every time we see God said, that's a transition. So on the second day, God divided waters, and there was room below then for life. Verse 9, another, and God said, Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, as it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas, and God saw that it was good. So, we now see in verse 11, and God said. So, in the third box, you have God gathering the waters to reveal dry land, and I put that down as day 3-A. Because God said twice. He says something twice on the third day. And the second time he says it, starting in verse 11, the earth was to bring forth grass and herb yielding seed and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herbs yielding seed after his kind and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind, and God saw that it was good. And now we know that the evening and the morning were the third day. So on the third day, in the first portion of the chapter, or the reading, we saw that he gathered waters to reveal dry land. And then on the second part of that day, vegetation after its kind. So two things happened on the third day. That's why there's 4 boxes in the first line. You get it? And maybe now you know why there's 4 boxes in the second line. And God said. So we have this transition, and we move now to the second series of boxes. Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs, seasons, days, and years. and then let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars, and God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, to divide the light from the darkness. And God called it good, or correct. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. So the fourth day, that second series, he's got heavenly lights that he has organized in their places, the sun, the moon, and the stars. And while it says it was good at the end of verse 18, another word that can be translated there besides good is correct. That's why I use that word. And a topic for another time, in verse 14, I mentioned to you, let them be for signs. Well, it's let them be signs and seasons and days and years. So in verse 14, you could leave the word for, F-O-R, out. Now again, this is a whole different topic. I'll cover it with you some other time. But you notice something's left out in 14? Weeks and months. Why is that left out? Okay, that's another time. And God said that this was in the fourth day. So heavenly lights are put in their position. We move to the second box in the second line. And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that has life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created the great whales and every living creature that moves, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let fowl multiply in the earth. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. So the fifth day, there are fish and fowl. And then your eye will drift to verse 24, and God said. And if you want to get a head start, you can also see that in verse 26. So day six, two things occurred. The first is that there is an earth bringing forth living creatures after his kind, cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth after his kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps upon the earth after his kind, and God saw that it was good. And the second thing noted then, and God said, that let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish, the fowls, the cattle, and everything on the earth. So God created them in his own image, male and female created in them. And he told them to be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. Interesting, it says replenish, isn't it? And subdue it and have dominion and so forth. So day six has a part A with land animals, and the fourth box on that second row is mankind is created. So we have then 6B. In verse 29, there is another God said, and that is an overview of all that he had done in the creation week. It is really overviewed well with verse 31, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. So in the first two areas, we have, or first two lines of boxes, we have the 6 days of creation, noting that the third day and the sixth day are divided into two parts. So I ask you then the question and give you some multiple choice. What are the four principles at work in creation week? Circle one in each box. Unless you make a mistake, I'll tell you what they are. day one and day four, light, dark, heavenly lights, each have their own place. On day two, the waters divided in fish and fowl. There is separation. Fish and fowl don't work together in the same environment unless the bird's fishing. In day 3A and day 6A, waters are gathered to reveal dry land, and then there's land animals. There is a place where motion can take place. And on the day 3B and 6B, life. So those are the four principles that work in creation week: place, separation, motion, and life. It's important that you know that. And we could maybe use other words, but that's important that you know those four principles. So I hope you can see the parallel between the first 3 days of creation and the second 3 days of creation. If they follow each other, there's two trails going on here. One, and then there's another one laid over it. It's an overlay. What are the three blessings of the creation week? I put in some scriptures, Genesis 1:22. Be fruitful and multiply. Genesis 1:28. Have dominion. That's a blessing. And Genesis 2:3, separated and holy. He blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. So these are the three blessings of the creation week. Now, what is the ascending order of freedom of motion as outlined during the creation week? If you think about this, in number one, the one item God created that has the smallest amount of motion, it would really be the least motion, would be plant life. You know, you only have to mow the grass every 2 weeks. It doesn't grow real fast. Sometimes you'll go on vacation and you'll eat and drink and you'll grow too fast. And you go home and you diet, right? Now, if you mow the grass on every Friday, it looks great for the weekend. If you come home Friday and you're tired and you don't mow the grass, on Sunday or Monday, it's grown twice as much. So sometimes the law doesn't stand. But basically, the concept is where there's the smallest amount of motion is in plant life. The second one, and this is then from our perspective, where is the smallest amount of motion and freedom of motion, is sun, moon, and stars. You have to look at the stars for a long time before you see things have moved a little bit. It might take two nights, for the rotation is enough for you to determine things have moved a little bit. Of course, it's we that have moved. The next part of creation that has the next greatest freedom of motion is fish and sea creatures. They can swim in the waters, but they don't swim well in the air. And so we come to the fourth area where there's freedom of motion. And that would be birds, because they can fly in the air, and they can also dive in the water, and they can walk on the land. The fifth area of freedom of motion, I'm working backwards, is animals. Cows can walk in the water, they can walk on the land. pigs fly if you listen to enough music. And of course, the one part of creation that moves the most is mankind. We figured out with our intelligence how to survive in water for a real long time in a submarine. We've learned how to go above our heavens into outer space and survive a long time. We can walk on the water. People can swim across channels. We can do unusual things. Mankind has the most range of motion. So now we come to what binds this all together in Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3, the creation of the Sabbath. We'll find four principles revealed here about the Sabbath at its creation. So 2 verse 1, thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them, and on the seventh day God ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. Now, it's interesting again that you see that he says he ended his work. That doesn't mean he finished it. He ended it. Just like when you come to Friday and you leave your workplace, there's still stuff to do Monday when you come back. There's something to do. And there's still us that he is working on. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. The four principles that are mentioned here, the first one that I have for you is place. The Sabbath was appointed as its place the seventh day. The second principle is separation. God blessed the seventh day. No other day is blessed. The third principle is motion. Taking a note from 2:2, God ceased from motion on the Sabbath. It was a work of cessation. He ceased working. And the fourth principle is life. God put his presence, his life, into the Sabbath. And he has not taken his presence out of the Sabbath. Nowhere in the Bible do you find that God said, I'm no longer the God of the Sabbath. Christ says that he is the Lord, the master of the Sabbath. So these four principles are the Sabbath in its creation. In these first three verses of chapter 2, the Sabbath has its place, it's separate from other days, it's a law where we cease motion, and it's a law, a principle, where we understand life, and that God has put his life into this day. And if you cast your eye back up to where I said the four principles at work in creation week, those same four principles were put into place during creation week, everything eventually pointing to the Sabbath. So sometimes it's a very important matter to look at these principles when we're trying to arrive at an understanding what we should do on the Sabbath. I look at a room full of people, but I don't see any practicing Jews here. With 39 laws of what you do and don't do. You are a people based on godly principle. And so in all of our understanding of the Sabbath, we need to make sure that we understand that it has its place, that it's separated from the other days, that in that separation, the things and the motions of life cease in our normal operations. And then we make sure that God is involved in the Sabbath. And so I think now you can know more about what Christ was referring to when he made the statement in Mark 2:27, the Sabbath was made for man. That's a reflection of all of the days of creation. And understanding that, then, we can see forward into the millennium, because it tells us the four principles that will be participating in our lives and all lives that willingly participate, that will be in the time that is yet to come, the kingdom of God. We are in the age of man now. There was the age of Satan, but the age of God is coming. And in that time, there'll be a place, there'll be a separation, there'll be the motion that is godly, and the life of God in those times. So the Sabbath has its place in the week. It is blessed. And we cease from our motions so the presence of God can be witnessed and enjoyed. And there's a number of things where sometimes we'll point the finger at each other and wonder about, well, is this or that? And I say, you know, we came into a knowledge of the Sabbath, and then we start looking around what other people have been doing, and we see what Seventh-day Adventists do, we see what Jewish people do, we might see what other people do on their day of worship, and we then try to parrot it in some way, saying, this is how we keep the Sabbath. And sometimes we win and sometimes we lose. But in all matters, we should win by knowing the four principles of the Sabbath that God put into the entirety of creation week. So now I would just suggest it's a time that we make sure that we're stable, that our spiritual constitution is strong. We discern our relationship with our Maker on the Sabbath. And we can certainly ensure our spiritual footing, stabilizing ourselves and improve our relationship with God by understanding the Sabbath and keeping it properly, following the example of the general who created it all. These Pharisees didn't talk to him about his creation time. They talked to him about their do's and don'ts. You're now more equipped to know the meaning of made in Mark 2. It'll take the rest of our lives to perfect it.